spotted dogs and bloodshot eyes. Our space captain laughs and tries to understand the scheme of things. And just in time, the scene has changed. The bus is here, bring the beer.
And everybody.
Morning, John.
My good buddy, Stuart Acuff is here in the studio.
Good morning, friends and neighbors. Great to be with you this morning. Thanks for tuning in to Epic Radio, the rock of Appalachia, baby.
That's right, buddy. Broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, atop the Four Seasons bookstore right in German Street in the middle of Shepherdstown. And my name is John Case, and we're expecting Samuel Brown to be here shortly. And president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, Kenny Perdue, going to be calling in around 8 o'clock. Let me keep my little mixer on quarter blast there so I can hear him when he calls in. I'm going to open up this morning with... I'm going to read from an article published in The Guardian this morning. And it's by Thomas Piketty, who wrote the best book on economics.
In a long, long time.
In a long time. about a year and a half ago. And, of course, it sold more than any economics book in recent history. Maybe going all the way back to... I don't know how far you'd have to go back to get sell as many books as he. I don't think anybody ever sold any more economics books than him.
Probably not.
Maybe a textbook manufacturer someplace, but maybe.
Robert Samuelson, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah, right. Oh, not Robert, the daddy. Paul Samuelson. Yeah, Paul Samuelson, right.
The primer on economics.
Right, and he was, of course, Paul was a very smart guy. Everybody knows that. But anyway, this is... the headline of Piketty's article. Now you got to keep in mind that headlines are not always written by the author.
They're never written by the author. Let me just assure you, headlines are never written by the author.
So, anyway, the headline is: "We must rethink globalization, or Trumpism will prevail." Let it be said at once: Trump's victory is primarily due to the explosion in economic and geographic inequality in the United States over several decades, and the inability of successive governments to deal with this. Both the Clinton and Obama administrations frequently went along with the market liberalization launched under Ronald Reagan and both Bush presidencies. At times, they even outdid them. The financial and commercial deregulation carried out under Bill Clinton is an example. What sealed the deal, though, was the suspicion that the Democrats were too close to Wall Street. Excuse me. And the inability of the Democratic media elite to learn the lessons from just the Sanders vote.
Yes. Yes, John.
Hillary won the popular vote by a whisker, 60.1 million votes against 59.8 million for Trump, out of a total adult population of 240 million. But the participation of the youngest and lowest income groups was much too low to enable key states to be won.
Right.
The tragedy is that Trump's program...
And people of color.
He gets to that in a second here. The tragedy is that Trump's program will only strengthen the trend towards inequality. He intends to abolish health insurance, laboriously granted to low-paid workers under Obama, and to set the country on a headlong course into fiscal dumping, with a reduction from 35% to 15% in the rate of federal tax on corporation profits. Whereas to date, the United States has resisted this trend already witnessed in Europe. In addition, the increasing role of ethnicity, his word for racism, I guess, in American politics does not bode well for the future if new compromises are not found. In the United States, 60% of the white majority votes for one party, while 70% of the minorities vote for the other. That's an interesting statistic, right?
It's very interesting.
In addition to this, the majority is on the verge of losing its numerical, of losing its numerical advantage, 70% of the votes cast in 2016 as compared to 80% in 2000 and 50% forecast in 2040.
Right. That's inevitable.
The main lesson for Europe and the world is clear. As a matter of urgency, globalization must be fundamentally reoriented. The main challenges of our times are the rise in inequality and global warming. We must therefore implement international treaties enabling us to respond to these challenges and to promote a model for fair and sustainable development. Agreements of this type, if necessary, include measures aimed at facilitating these exchanges. But the question of liberalizing trade should no longer be the main focus for us.
Right.
Trade must once again become a means in the service of higher ends. It should never have become anything other than that.
Yes.
There should be no more signing of international agreements that reduce customs duties and other commercial barriers without including quantified and binding measures to combat fiscal and climate dumping in those same treaties. For example, there should be a common minimum rates of corporate tax and targets for carbon emissions, which can be verified and sanctioned. It is no longer possible to negotiate trade treaties for free trade with nothing in exchange. From this point of view, CETA, the EU-Canada free trade deal, should be rejected. It's a treaty which belongs to another age. This strictly commercial treaty contains absolutely no restrictive measures concerning fiscal or climate issues. It does, however, contain a considerable reference to the, quote, protection of investors. This enables multinationals to sue states under private arbitration courts, bypassing the public tribunals available to one and all.
Which under you know,
in I think I'll stop there for a second. It's an article that's worth reading. It's in the Guardian.
Besides the economic argument, those tribunals undermine democracy. They take essential questions for the people of nation states out of the hands of the democratic process and put it in the hands, as Bernie Sanders has said time and time and time again, in the hands of corporate attorneys, corporate operatives, lobbyists, and the like, who are not working in the interests of average people, but are working in the interests of their corporate masters. I hate to sound like a stodgy lefty, but that's true. We take out of our own hands and give over to somebody else who doesn't represent us the fight for adequate wages, the fight for a better standard of living, the fight for a better future for our kids, the fight to save the environment, the fight to live a healthy life, the fight for our own quality of life. Now, globalization is not the only culprit here, but remember, friends and neighbors, we've had 40 years of stagnant wages in America. And part of that reason is that globalization took from us, you know, in industrial jobs, industrialism, and forced a change in our economy. And what happened was we moved to a service sector economy without the right to organize unions. And so we moved to a low-wage economy with no way to get ourselves out of that low-wage economy, no way to lift the standard of living. And hence, you know, that's part of the reason. That's a big part of the reason. The change in the economy and the deunionization of the American working class is a big part of the reason we've had 40 years of stagnant wages. No wonder people are pissed off. And no wonder people voted their anger.
Which sometimes took a left turn and but took a right turn as well. I mean,
right.
You know.
Right. But, you know, Mrs. Clinton did not provide an answer for this essential question, which is, your own quality of life. And this happens over and over and over again. And John's heard me say this 1,000 times, but maybe you haven't heard me say this. When Democrats do not make a case for improving your quality of life and your children's future, they lose because then people vote social issues. And
which are divisive, tend to be divisive.
And we are much more conservative as a people, as Americans, on social issues than we are on economic issues.
That's true. I think that's true. People would like to get fairly treated.
Right.
I mean, money, let's keep in mind, why is money so important? It's the means of life.
We all
know that, right? I mean, we should know that. we live in an economy where, you know, everything that you need to live has a price, just about. I mean, there are some public goods, but everything you need to live pretty much requires money. So equity, equality, or justice is often, you know, enumerated in financial terms. I want to read the last sentence of Piketty's, a paragraph of Piketty's article, because it summarizes what he's trying to say. It's time to change the political discourse on globalization. Trade is a good thing. Both fair and sustainable development also, however, demands public services, infrastructure, health and education systems. In turn, these themselves demand fair taxation systems. If we fail to deliver these, Trumpism, which is fascism, folks, will prevail. And I think that that's, you know, that, I mean, it's, how do you approach changing it so that the discourse on trade includes provisions for sharing the gains from trade, okay, in your own country?
Right.
Appropriately. That's the most important question, right? I mean, a lot of times you cannot dictate really what another country is going to do. You know, you can't go, as I had a guest on the program, well, we ought to go in and demand that that country institute the following 30 reforms and whatever before we, and we should demand that they get their government representatives out of the table and have somebody else come in, you know, all that kind of stuff, right?
Donald Trump's fixing to be handed a serious lesson in that question from China.
Yeah, he is. He's going to tell the Chinese what to do, and the Chinese are going to say something on their own that I don't think will follow Mr. Trump's script. So, so, you know, you lead by example, I think. And now, if you had agreements based on that, I mean, in other words, it's not so much, you know, okay, let's say we were going to reduce tariffs or barriers with trade for some country, Canada or Mexico, the NAFTA basic thing. But what happened if we had said, hey, the gains from trade will be taxed appropriately and they will be invested in, what does Piketty say here? Public services, infrastructure, health and education systems.
Right.
Okay. Okay. There you go. I mean, now you can have, you know, now if Mexico or Canada decides to waste their money or whatever, I think the tendency would be very strong for them to, you know, do likewise. Okay, right. If they want to, but when we set the example ourselves of we negotiate a trade agreement and all the gains go to the 1%, which they have,
absolutely,
you know, really,
absolutely,
you know, I mean, why should they do any different?
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I mean,
absolutely.
You know, so you, yeah.
As so many writers on global trade and the global economy have written, the gains of trade go to the elites as it's organized now, and the elites get far richer, and the average people either stand still or move backwards. The best example of that is manufacturing wages in Mexico dropped by 10% after the implementation of NAFTA.
How long after did it drop? I thought it was like 2 or 3 years. It was after the crisis, you know, when the labor market got swamped with all the people
right.
that got thrown out of agriculture. That's right. Because I remember there was
right.
a thing.
That's probably right.
They
John.
Went up incrementally, not that much, but
right.
a little bit. And then the, you right. know, crapped right. out completely when
right.
the farmers had to go try to get work.
Yeah, I mean, let's remember, this is a very little known fact, that NAFTA forced the removal of subsidies on the growing of rice and, of corn and beans in Mexico.
Right.
And then you had a crisis in the cities because there was not enough tortillas and the cost of tortillas skyrocketed. So you literally had this this influx of Mexican workers to be able to feed their families.
Well, yeah. I mean, where else are they going to go?
Right.
You know, I mean, there was apparently 5 to 7 million of them.
Right. And what we've seen around the world is if capital moves seamlessly around the globe, people are going to follow capital because that's how working people live.
Except in the high wage history, high tech history, industries, the opposite tends to be true. Capital follows the labor. Or right. It was starting to. You know, if you, for example, my wife who studies this, centers of innovation in the economy, right? Mm-hmm. And she identified three. I think there was worked on three around Austin, around Cambridge, Massachusetts, uh-huh. and around Silicon Valley, right?
San Jose.
Where you had this, you know, big concentration of innovative new high-tech companies, right?
Right.
In each of these. And it does tend to cluster, right? In other words, the right. companies, the investors, hey, I want to have a high-tech startup in the hills of West Virginia. Well, who's going to be working in it?
Right.
Okay. I mean, everyone that's got the brains is headed to these centers, you know.
Right.
I mean, all the workers that, and we have to go there. And it right. turned out that, of course, that almost all startup capital was also concentrated in these areas where you had these high concentrations of high-tech workers.
And they attracted more high-tech workers.
That's right.
One of my neighbors, when I lived in Evanston, right outside of Chicago, a couple who were both postdoctoral academics,
right.
both had gotten their PhDs. This is in 2000. Brilliant people. They moved to Austin, Texas. That's where their work was, and Austin was begging for postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, sure, yeah.
If
yeah.
you're a postdoctoral student at the University of Chicago, you probably have options.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do. I mean, if you get yourself a PhD in computer science from practically anywhere, I'm sure you can probably get work, you know, or big data or some of the new pharma things or the,
right.
You know, all these advanced.
Well, pharma, John, pharma is a perfect example of how deregulation or unregulation of the global economy has forced more and more suffering on the American people. You know, I mean, this is now becoming almost said too much, but if you compare the cost of medicines in the United States and in Canada, America fails that test. Big Pharma controls the market in the United States, and they raise costs of medicine. Even once the patent they bypass the patent, it still continues to climb, and that's mm-hmm. because they control the market.
Right,
the U.S. government does not force the kind of competition using the United States consumption of those medicines through Medicare and Medicaid, Veterans Administration, and other systems of health care that the United States government controls. They do not use the power of their input into the healthcare market to create competition between pharmaceutical companies, and therefore prices go up. That's a layman's. I mean, that's way below John Case's
no.
articulation.
No.
That's very much a layman's explanation of an economic point. As I've often said, to introduce a little levity to the program, I'm not an economist, but I play one on TV.
There you go. That's right. That's like Che Guevara. You know, when Fidel asked after the revolution, he says, well, we're going to need an economist. And he looked around his crowd of revolutionaries, and I don't think he was expecting to find one.
Right.
And but Shea raised his hand.
Right.
And Fidel said, well, Shea, I knew you were a great revolutionary and a doctor, but I didn't know you knew anything about economics. And he said, well, I thought you said communist. But I can be an economist, too. Anyway, welcome to the program. This must be Mike Diesel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is America. Oh, the ships at sea. Vehicles on the ground. Pay engineer.
Hey, we just got Mr. Roosevelt, but we just got a call from, I just got a message from Sammy Brown saying that she's not going to be in this morning. She wants to come in tomorrow because she has a job interview.
Ah, I get that.
This morning, so we're going to have to postpone that one.
Okay.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy.
Welcome to Labor Beat.
Good morning, everybody. It is, you're listening to Epic Radio.
We are.
Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio. Today's show with your original dusty-footed philosopher, Mr. Judd Case, is our theme show, Labor Beat, filling in for Mr. Christensen, is Mr. Acuff. Good morning, everybody.
Well, had Hillary won the election, I would be here talking this morning about and responding to Stuart's little essay there on globalization and the pharmaceuticals. I would be saying, okay, it's time to get a corporate form, talk to the president's team about putting a public representative on these too-big-to-fail giants. Do they really have to be that big in order to do all the research and all this other stuff to get it out in the market or not? And, you know, we have a public interest in it. But now, that's obviously one of those things that I could go out there and talk about that for the next 8 years, and, you know, tell me to go pee up a rope.
But that is part of the reason that Germany has such a high standard of living and such a great trade balance.
That's true. Well, they're very export.
Absolutely.
They have a trade surplus.
Right.
By the way, protectionism hurts countries with trade surpluses more than it does those with trade
deficits.
But in the end, it hurts both, okay? The only thing that really satisfies both sides of a trade agreement, really, both surpluses and deficits, is a growth strategy, frankly, okay?
Right.
And if you have that, then everybody can maybe win. But my thought was is that that's a long way. That's not going to be on the agenda until this regime is overthrown.
Well, it's interesting because, Trump, his rhetoric was so much against the TPP and so much against trade agreements as we know them. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, he's not going to put worker representatives on negotiating bodies to negotiate trade agreements. And, we know that.
I don't think he's going to mess with corporate organization at all.
Right, right. I don't either.
You know, how could he?
Right.
But that
goes against his rhetoric. I mean, he lost Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. He won Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin in part because he railed against the TPP.
Right.
Putting the trade union movement in a real box. Those are heavily union states. And industrial union states, and the unions were campaigning against TPP.
And so was Trump. And Hillary was on the fence.
Right, exactly. And Bernie had campaigned against TPP, and Bernie had made a serious case about it. And average union workers, average workers, especially industrial workers, manufacturing workers, we're looking at this and seeing, well, this is what matters to me most, my job. And that's where I'm going.
I think Bernie's campaign against TP was pitched incorrectly, in my opinion. And I think falling into the TPP, international trade is a complicated issue. You can think that you can adopt a policy to protect your jobs, but that very protection can end up killing you. And it's such an easy issue to be trapped into, you know, fascist and ultra right wing nationalism. Okay, that you know you can it's a very troubling thing unless you're very very concrete about. If you just say I don't want to trade, I'm sorry, you're going to lose. And Trump will not say no trade. I guarantee he will not do that. Okay, he may go after China in some way, but he'll just wait until China says, "Well, you owe us several trillion dollars that we have loaned you through our, you know, that we've borrowed from you at we've loaned you at practically zero interest rates."
Right.
Okay. And we may just raise the interest rate on that, okay, and see what that happens now when someone doesn't want to buy your debt anymore. I mean, they have a lot. They have some very powerful weapons to make us go to 25 or 30% unemployment again,
right.
Easily.
Yep.
Now you want to get in a trade war? Okay, I don't. You might. How are you going to win it? There is no way to win it. Which is why I believe that, you know, the approach to trade is not yay or nay on trade agreements per se, but we would be better off saying we are totally in favor of trade, but pay us, pay everybody involved, okay? Because otherwise you're in a position that what happened to Trump took it.
But John,
he took it.
I don't disagree at all. And if you were making those decisions, I would totally trust them. Nuance works in policy. Nuance does not work in politics.
And, well, that's true.
And